Welcome to the Teams Podcast. We're talking 1879, when Michigan scored the first touchdown in the history of football, kicked the extra point, and had it called back. Okay, season two of the Teams Podcast. I'm Seth Fisher with Dr. Sapp. We'd like to thank our sponsor, that's Matt Demarest of Homeshore Lending. If you're getting yourself refinanced or if you're buying a home, he's the guy to call. We also brought in the venerable...
Esteemed.
It's not esteemed. Old.
Well, let's put it this way.
Knowledgeable.
We're doing the 1879 team, so we had to bring someone in who was around. And you were just a 2,850-year-old druid at that point.
I just vaguely remember it at this point.
So this is Craig Ross with us, and we're going to talk about the first team, Team 1. Our format's going to change a little bit for this one because normally we have, you know, a whole section on the games, and there's two games.
Not much to talk about.
Right, and the players, there's, 12 of them. What's fascinating about this team, not only is it the first, is that it's like part of the story of the origins of college football and where this game comes from. And I think most of the stuff that people think they know about college football is wrong.
I agree with that.
Yeah, so I want to dive right into like where this game comes from. Why? How did it get to America? How did colleges start playing it? How did colleges start playing each other in it? And then how did Michigan start theirs?
Yeah, I mean, the... clearly, soccer in England morphed into rugby. Mm-hmm. That much is probably undeniable. How soccer morphed into rugby isn't all that clear. And the game rugby is actually named after a prep school in England.
The rugby school.
And it seems like the derivation is from a letter sent by a guy named William Bloxham, who went to the rugby school, written to the rugby school saying, you know, rugby did really start here at our school in 1823. The letter is 1876, when a guy named William Webb Ellis at a soccer game picked up a ball and started running. Just
Huzzah!
You're not allowed to do that in soccer. Right, you can't touch the ball with your hands.
And so, oh my God, nobody thought of using their hands before.
Right. And so, and out of that comes the notion that rugby was born. The problem is it's probably not true. Because a guy named Thomas Hughes, who wrote a pretty famous book called Tom Brown's School Days, was a student at the rugby school back close, if not right at that time.
Right.
And he said, nah, bullshit. Never happened. Couldn't have happened. Wouldn't have happened. Any kid who would have picked the ball up at that time probably would have been pummeled to death.
Right.
And run with it. So it didn't happen. And so actually how soccer... became rugby isn't all that clear. You have some ideas
about it, Seth, and I
think they may be right.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff's going into our book, but it takes a whole lot of research to figure it out, because there's not a lot written about it. But all through the Middle Ages, there were games at marketplaces or between towns, and it was just, you know, people getting on a field and either kicking a ball around or moving a ball. There was one game which I loved, the description of, where the two towns were about 2 miles away from each other. So they put the ball exactly in between the two towns. Everyone starts about 50 yards away from each other. They run at each other. And by the end of the day, whoever's got the ball closest to their town wins. And they're like, if you can get it into your town and kick it over the church's pew, then that also will end the game. Anything else, there's no rules. You could pick it up, you could kick it, you could throw it, you could punt it. But these games existed all over Europe. England certainly had lots of them. And I think from town to town, the rules are different. I think sometimes they had games where you picked the ball up and ran with it. Games were probably similar to rugby back then.
Well, was it a ball or was it a bladder, animal bladder? How sophisticated was it back then?
That's a really good question. And I don't know the answer.
Yeah, the answer is all of the above.
I mean,
these things were not very organized. Part of the thing is there were a lot of laws around. Lords didn't particularly like these town games, they called them, because town games don't prepare you for war. They wanted you doing martial games, like archery or wrestling was a big thing, or boxing.
To defend your country.
Right.
They didn't want the townies playing town games.
Right. Well, their military might and their ability to project military might depended on how many people they could call up at a certain time and march with.
Okay.
So if they were, you know, if my guys were all playing soccer and the other guys were all doing archery, guess who's going to win when we go to fight each other?
Right.
So but the towns would play them anyway, but there's not a lot written about them because the churches didn't care about them and the lords didn't care about them, and that's who really controlled who wrote history back then.
So the game was frowned upon.
Games were... I mean, we're talking like huge generalities, right?
Okay.
There's also stories of the lords jumping in and playing, too.
Hmm.
So, especially up in Scotland. that was
interesting.
Whole different thing. But yeah, getting into the history of these sports is difficult. And you can find the origins of baseball in like the game Rounders back then. Mm-hmm. Kids would play these games all the time. So like a lot of times they're written in like little booklets of children's games.
Yeah.
But the games are really just kind of passed from kids to kids down on a playground or a field or wherever they were, right?
Nothing formalized, right?
The first actual formal rugby rules was in the late 1860s or early 1870s, there was something called the Rugby Football Union.
Right.
And they created the first set of formal rules, which was 1871, which keep that date in mind as we go along here.
Right.
That the Rugby Football Union didn't even have rules until 1871.
Right.
So
that's interesting because we were talking earlier, and I'm just going to talk about this. The first baseball game in North America was supposedly played in Canada in 1838. So it predates, you know, the football or rugby concept. So things are evolving, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's certainly true that baseball predates football in the United States and in the colleges. I mean, Michigan played football as early as 1867, I believe.
Right. And they had a team by 1869.
Yeah.
An actual, would you call it a team or would it be a, like an intramural
I mean, they, level the baseball team? Tracks its founding to 1865.
Okay.
So baseball was a game that a lot of, they were playing in New York on fields. Elysium Fields is kind of where the origin story comes from. But it's really a game that kind of came out of Rounders.
Okay.
And the American version, I think probably used the fact that like American fields were mostly square. So they were using the dimensions that they had instead of the long Rounders field that you would need. Uh-huh. Right.
Right.
Because Rounders was based in English enclosures. I'm getting way into the weeds.
Yeah.
But the Civil War, it spread like wildfire. Everyone went and played it during the Civil War, and then it came. And after that, it was almost already the national pastime. Everyone came home from that playing it. And Michigan's team founds itself right after, like in 1865. It's like already there. So
an interesting, for me, footnote is that there was a guy on the Michigan baseball team named Marcus Fleetwood Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcus Fleetwood Walker was black, was a catcher, played at Michigan. And his brother, Weldy Walker, was also a catcher. Who played on the Michigan team a little later. Marcus Fleetwood Walker is actually the first African-American to play Major League Baseball, not Jackie Robinson.
What?
Yes, because the color line didn't start until 1900.
Right.
And in the 1890s, Marcus Fleetwood Walker and then later Weldy Walker both played catcher for, I think the team name was the Toledo Blue Sox or the Toledo Glass Sox. Maybe it was Toledo Glass Sox.
It could have been both back then.
Yeah, and they were definitely considered a major league team at the time. And both Walker brothers played for them. But the color line wasn't established until 1900. Now, that's not to say there were very many black athletes playing baseball in the 1890s, but the first who did were the Walker brothers.
Wow.
And
that's incredible.
Unknown or not very well known.
Yeah, that's great.
Fact. Yeah. So, I mean, baseball was really kind of the first intercollegiate tradition. Mm-hmm. The first time you see colleges getting together and playing each other in an athletic contest. I think gymnastics were probably the very first thing they did. And then followed by rowing. And then followed by baseball was probably the first like field game that they played with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the tradition comes out of England, and mm-hmm. they brought their rules from England. I guess we can go from there to like the athletics. You kind of gave the segue to the athletics at University of Michigan. Like, how did Michigan athletics begin?
Well, that's a really good question. I actually, you know, think aside from baseball, which was going on here in mm-hmm. late 1860s, it might have come with a guy named Gailey, and I'm trying to think of his first name, William something Gailey, and he was born in Shanghai, educated at Oxford, and then came to Michigan to study Latin and literature, and became a PhD and a professor here. And he organized games on campus. They were intramural games primarily.
Okay. All right.
But he organized certain 11-on-11 games. Now, what those 11-on-11 games look like, I'm guessing sort of more soccerish than anything else. But Gailey organized them and was key to doing athletic stuff at the Michigan campus. Interestingly enough, he wrote The Yellow and the Blue. He wrote, and he then later became a very famous academic at Cal Berkeley, and he wrote their alma mater.
Is it also The Yellow and the Blue?
No, it's very similar, though, and I wonder.
Blue and yellow?
I've often wondered if there was some.
It's the blue and Amarillo.
Yeah. If there was some connection.
Hail to the colors, a slightly different yellow and blue.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think.
I don't actually know the words to our alma mater.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what the name of the, in any event, of the Cal alma mater is. But he finished his academic career at
the
Berkeley.
The Golden Azure.
Yeah, and he also wrote their alma mater. So he was an interesting guy. But at the same time, you had something called the Rush going
on. The Rush.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, this was another thing that probably came out of old town games, right? Mm-hmm. So back then, if you imagine, the Diag had a big fence around it. And there were just a few buildings on campus, and they were all kind of spotted around the Diag. And the sophomores were on one end, and the freshmen were on the other. So there's this tradition every year. They'd line up on their respective sides of the Diag. And at the whistle or start or whatever, they'd all run at each other. And it wasn't over until everyone had been thrown over the fence. So you had to go and push them back
so
to their spot.
I was telling Craig, this is like the old game that we used to play as kids called British Bulldogs.
Yes.
Where you would send one person over to try and break the chain of the other team.
Yeah.
But now they're literally throwing them over the fence.
That's sending one guy over.
Right.
Everybody runs at each other.
This was a free-for-all.
This was a melee. I mean, this is the next thing closest to war, right? Where it was all hand fighting, and, you know, sometimes you had to knock a guy out first before he's willing to go over the fence.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people, especially Angel when he came on board, who did not like the Rush and thought that this was a major problem. One of the things they did was they introduced this 7-foot or 8-foot ball. And you can go and find all sorts of athletic pictures because this lasted until the 1930s. But there was just gigantic ball. Mm-hmm. And they changed the tradition. Instead of throwing each other over the fence, you had to throw this ball over the fence.
Okay.
And it was still just an absolute melee.
Sure.
And like there was a lot of class pride. Remember, it's a much smaller school back then, right?
Right, right.
So like everyone knows each other really well. And your class comes in and your class is like your group of friends. So there was a lot of... They were mostly organized class versus class, so freshmen versus sophomores.
Right.
And
it was mostly freshmen and sophomores for whatever reason. Maybe by the time they were juniors, they were smart enough to know that.
I mean, after one rush,
maybe you had two.
Right, after one, you're like, okay, I know how to do this now, and I'm gonna get them. After two, you're like, I don't need to take this.
We should have somebody recreate that. We should make a video of that. It should be some project for a student. Let's recreate the game.
I think at times students on campus have tried to recreate some of these games. I know they tried to redo the ball one in the 1990s because we covered it on the daily. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't stick.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And the two things I've often wondered, and I don't know, I haven't really researched it or spent enough time on it, is I wonder if this is where Fraternity Rush has something in its
origins,
and also whether rushing in football has any connection to these old...
That does.
This old rusher.
That does, because the position was called rusher.
Rusher.
And that's kind of what we'll call a blocker now. Okay. But a rusher is someone who's, you know, running forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the rush is probably, once again, you know, old origins, where, like, once you get too deep into time, you can't really figure out the origins anymore. But I think it was probably, yes, a reference to that, or at least from the same root.
Yeah, so there were a lot of informal athletics going on at the university. And then there was also baseball, basically. Yeah. They might play Ann Arbor High School, or they may have had some intercollegiate games.
Well, they started a rowing team, too. Mm-hmm. So these are very informal. And what would happen was the students would get together and say, we want to do this. So I think the original ones were tennis and rowing and some sort of gymnastics. They were always going after a gym. They didn't get for years.
Waterman Gymnasium. If you go back and look at the papers, and this starts before the Daily. I read for our book, the book Seth and I wrote still working on.
But you wrote and I'm rewriting.
Well, yeah, you're rewriting. I read every Michigan Daily from 1890 to 1900.
Oh, my gosh.
And it took a lot of time, but it was really fascinating. But there were papers in Ann Arbor before that. There was the Chronicle that was sort of a student-ish paper, and there was another called the Courier, which was sort of a towny paper. And
well, there's also the Michigan Alumnus, which would be covering like all the...
That was a little later, I think, although I could be wrong.
I think that one started in the 1880s.
Okay, that would be a little before the Daily. But finding stuff in those papers is really hard. I mean, there's no organization or...
Yeah, and they're very interested in academics. So, like, you end up reading a whole bunch of the science building and we're going to create a new chemistry building and all that stuff.
But you can see, even in the late 1880s, in the Chronicle, there's this clamoring for a gymnasium. How come we don't have a gymnasium here in Ann Arbor?
Oh, they were doing fundraisers on campus all the time.
Constantly. Until some guy in the mid-1890s named Waterman donated $35,000 or $3,500, whatever it was.
Right. And then up to the point, like, after 20 years of organizing, they probably had, like, $2,100.
Right. Basically,
yeah.
Right.
And then this guy donates, like, the amount built, and they build the thing. And then immediately after, I think they built a women's
addition.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
That's where the chemistry building is now, by the way.
If there were such an academic institution, why the focus on athletics? What prompted that?
This was part of like the culture back then. There was this into the 1840s and 1850s. There was this vision of academics as like, oh, send your kid to a college, he's going to go upstairs and like turn into like a white puppy, where he's never going to come out of his room. He's going to be reading his books all the time, and he's going to like waste away into this brain attached to like a nothing body. It wasn't the truth, but it was certainly like something that people thought about. And I think the University of Michigan realized that people thought that and were using like, oh, our boys go outdoors and do this.
Well, it wasn't just Michigan. It was everywhere. And I think the biggest impetus was post-machine age, where the churches got really freaked out because they thought, you know, women can now do these jobs too. We can't have that. We can't have women doing the same jobs as men.
How can we have masculinity when anyone can push a button?
And so this vision of, quote, muscular Christianity arose, which meant to be a man, it was fine to be learned and study, but you really need to be a man. You need to be a fighter. And so that was a major thing. And it was even, I think, more profound at schools like Oberlin, who was, of course, actually the Ohio University.
Right.
And at the time, and because Ohio State was nothing. And Oberlin College.
Right.
And in fact, there are famous games that Seth and I are writing about in the 1890s with Oberlin College. And one of the more better historians about the period is a guy named Nat Brandt from Oberlin, who's written some interesting stuff. But so this idea of muscular Christianity came around. But the university never, with the exception of Waterman Gymnasium, at least pre-1900, pretty much didn't want anything to do with athletics and pretty much left it up to the students to organize stuff.
Well, so that's why I want to talk about that, because when Yost comes, and I know we're getting ahead of it, but Yost says athletics for all. So it's interesting that you say that, because that wasn't really the mindset in Ann Arbor back then.
I mean,
it wasn't athletics for all. It wasn't even athletics.
It was a cultural mindset. That when you say athletics for all in that context, what you're doing is you're putting an ad out, right? You're like, oh, I believe in this, because everyone, it's going to ring true for a lot of people. And it's going to ring with this concept they have of the academic who's like wasting away in his dorm.
In the library.
Right. And Neither one is true, obviously, but it was that's the sense that they are coming out of. I mean, the original students at Michigan, when they moved to Ann Arbor from Detroit, like, their workout was going and chopping wood to keep their places warm. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they had some time to themselves, I'm sure they went outside and started organizing athletic contests. We'll see, though, with some of the members on this team, they're the guys who were organizing a greater athletics, and there have been a couple chances of doing this before. That kind of, you know, the senior class had a organization within the senior class that within the leadership that like organized athletics for that class. But having like one encompassing athletics association, they had called it back then.
Right.
Some of the members of this 1879 team were the founders of that same association. So there was, in the 1860s and 1870s, this movement on campus to get these more organized. And then if you wanted to start a sport, you had to recruit guys to do it. And you had to, you know, when Michigan's recruiting a football team, oh, we'll get into the story later, but they go and find guys who are playing other athletics. And they're like, hey, you're the best athlete on campus. Okay. Come join the football team.
Okay. Right. All right. Yeah. And but I guess, I don't know if we're at Princeton and Rutgers yet, but that certainly was an impetus.
Yeah.
I mean...
Because when's that? What year is that?
1869.
Right.
And... do you want us to start talking?
Yeah, let's go. Let's go talk about college football, because now we've got the athletics. Mm-hmm. You know, so let's talk about how this game comes out.
Well, Princeton and Rutgers is played in 1869, and it's to this day every fall on TV you'll hear it's the first college football game, intercollegiate football.
Right, it's
game.
The Abner Doubleday story for
right.
football,
right? And it's a completely bogus story, and nobody who's looked at it believes it. Now, there was a game. Between Princeton and Rutgers, no doubt about that. And it was probably a 25-on-23 soccer game,
right?
As far as I can tell.
Right. Especially from that famous picture, right? The painting, right?
Right.
It doesn't look like a football.
Well,
there's a ton of people.
It's
right?
a completely round ball, and the only way you can move it is kick it.
Yeah,
in that game.
Okay. Yeah, and the scoring of soccer,
sounds
too.
Sounds like soccer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you read the one newspaper article on it, and they're like, oh, they're talking about a soccer game.
Right.
And but it was intercollegiate.
It was intercollegiate.
And it was called football.
It was called football because they were using their foot to move the ball, I guess, the same
well, the,
as soccer.
Well, the game that both of these came out of was football. So there was rugby football, and there was football.
Right.
And when they said football, they meant it the same way that Europeans mean it now.
I think that's a really good point.
Okay.
Other historians who've looked at it, Nat Brand, I mentioned, a guy named Wyand, who wrote a history of football prior to, it's not a very good history, but it does have a lot of scores in it. Another guy, Park Davis, who I think actually played football in the 1890s, maybe for mm-hmm. Navy, he wrote a history, and none of them say, oh, this was a football game. And in fact, a historian at Princeton decided she would write about it, and I'm blocking on her name, April Armstrong, and she tries to rationalize it as the first football game. She really can't do it in the end. And so she says, well, you know, without this game, American football never would have started. That's as close as she could get. But
yeah, that's not a strong argument.
That's not an argument at all. You're right. But that's the best she can do.
Right.
But out of this, other schools got interested.
Yes.
So to that extent, she's right.
And again, we're coming out of the English tradition. Mm-hmm. And the universities were founded under the English tradition as well. And they had this tradition of campus sports that, again, was organized by the students, similarly to the way that they kind of just grew up at Michigan. And football was a very common one for British universities, mm-hmm. football being soccer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not like, you know, if you just take the American story, that you get Rutgers-Princeton.
Right.
And Rutgers-Princeton did do that. Remember, everyone had teams, and they were playing sophomores versus freshmen. They were playing juniors versus seniors. Like, that was what most of the schools were doing. They were organizing these contests between themselves. And there was already a rugby football game. I think they started calling it the Boston Rules because it was coming through Harvard, right?
Yeah, certainly at the time there was a major disputes about what the rules were should look like, and
because everyone got it from a different English town,
right? And there weren't that many schools playing it, but the ones that were all had their own sets of rules, and so pre-game they were often negotiated, you know,
right.
game by game as to what exactly the rules were, and you don't have great reporting on most or any of them, but between after the 1869 game, there's not a lot. In fact, in between, I went back and looked, between 1870 and 1872, I think there's seven games in those 3 years total.
Okay.
And I checked those fairly carefully. There's nothing in there that would look like they were soccer games.
Yeah, so what would happen a lot of times, they would play a couple games when they got together.
Right.
And sometimes they would, because there's a rules dispute, they would play one game under one guy's rules and then one game on the other guy's rules.
Okay.
But nothing there that would look much different than my guess than the 1869
game. Yeah, and I think what the game that became rugby, because the game that becomes rugby was still developed in England. So the game that became rugby kind of had its followers, and the game that became soccer had its followers. They're both called football, and there was a lot of tension, not just between like those overarching things, but also all these tiny rules that had developed on campuses because they played each other for years before they played other campuses.
Right. That's really a good point. And going back to my first footnote, remember that the Rugby Football Union didn't even establish any rules until 1871. So it seemed unlikely that anyone in the United States was actually playing under those rules in 1869 or 70, for example.
Right.
And I don't think there were any games in 1871 at all, and then in 1872, I think there were some games that maybe I've got the years out of sequence, but that's more or less true.
Yeah.
Now, but in the interim, students in Ann Arbor knew about these games and became interested, and so some kids from Cleveland who had other friends in Cleveland who went to Cornell were communicating. So there were kids who went to high school in Cleveland, some went to Cornell, some went to Michigan, and they were communicating about having a game in Cleveland. Was that 1874? 1873 or 4?
Yeah.
And they were going to play a game that probably would have been a soccer game or soccer-ish game is my guess. And it was all organized just by students, but then the Cornell president got wind of it and said no, I'm not going to send whatever it was 30 Cornell undergraduates to Cleveland to quote agitate a bag of wind.
Now again, is that because athletics is frowned upon and the reason you're here is to become academically learned?
It sounds to them like a game, right?
Yeah.
So like, hey mom, I want to go to San Diego and play my friends in tag. Right, like it to them, it seemed foolish. It was like, why are you stopping your studies?
It's an unstructured distraction.
Off, spending all this money and getting on a train and going to play some game.
Right. So I mean, so the game never happened essentially because Cornell chickened out, and I'm saying that to my brother if he's listening because he played football at Cornell. So
love it.
Anyway. It wouldn't be the first time Cornell chickened out of a game with Michigan.
Right. I know it would not be. They dumped one.
So let me ask you this, without getting too far ahead, when does the goalkeeper get lost or drop out of the actual terminology or schematics of the game? Because wouldn't that signify to you then that's when it becomes football?
So,
when there's no goal? Because I'm a former goalkeeper.
Okay.
Right? So when you lose that position, doesn't it become football?
Well, not really, because in these early games in the 1870s, as I understand them, most, they're not all the same. They all seem to be somewhat different.
Okay.
But as I understand it, if you kicked the ball beyond the end line, then you had the opportunity for a try.
Okay, so if you scored a touchdown, you had the opportunity for a
try.
Yeah, and then if you got the try,
you got the point.
You got the point.
But so if you didn't make the try, you got zero.
Right. We'll get into that again when we get into the Michigan's first game.
So you have to cross the goal line, but then you have to make the try.
Right.
Okay. And so, again, going back to where this game comes from, there was a disagreement between games whether you kick the ball over the field goal or whether you kick the ball in the field goal to score.
Right.
So if you just take, like, you know, a regular goal.
It's still an H-shaped frame, correct?
Right. That's why I still call it a field goal, because you have the goal right there.
Right.
It has to be over the crossbar.
Yeah. And if you get it, and there's kicking it over the crossbar to score, or there's kicking it inside the thing to score. And that was kind of a
dispute.
Another thing that had come out of these old games and one of the disputes that they were trying to figure out.
Okay.
They also had a big argument over how many players there should be. Like Rutgers and Princeton had 25 versus 23, and like maybe if more people had showed up, they could have had more.
Right.
The Rush had 100, people involved in it. And if you want to go back to, you know, some of these old town ball games, there could have been hundreds of people involved.
Sure. Right.
I think Boston rules, Harvard wanted 15, and they were trying to standardize around 15, and Yale was pushing for 11.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, they wouldn't play, in large part because of that. That they got into these pissing matches over the number of players, among other things, and so they wouldn't play. Well, when they finally did play, Yale had to concede.
Right, and they call it the concession.
And they call it the concessionary game or the concessionary rules. It was a lot of barking and woofing
There's still argument over whether they count that game in the Harvard-Yale record. Right.
Yeah, but they played with 15, and in fact.
Can we have that for the Appalachian State game? Can we call that? Put an asterisk by it.
No, Michigan State does that. They thought you could play with 12 against Arizona State one time. And
so they call it the concessionary game.
But then in 1874 is like a big change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Harvard plays McGill.
Right.
And
in Canada.
In Canada.
Another Canadian school. Another Canadian reference. Ding. Right.
Well, the Canadians had picked up rugby football.
Right.
And they didn't have a lot of soccer kind of getting in the way.
Right.
Okay. So they were having a lot more straight line development of the game of football.
Right.
So there were a lot of schools. Toronto was already starting to organize a team.
That's significant because Toronto comes into play. Yep.
And McGill organized a team, and McGill challenged Harvard, I believe.
That's correct. And they came down to Boston to play.
Yeah.
And they played a theoretical sequence of three games.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first game, they played straight up Harvard rules.
Right.
And
that meant 15 or 11? 15. 15.
15 on 15.
Okay.
Only thing that counted was
crossing the goal line?
No. You had to score a goal.
You had to score a goal by touching the ball down. Then you, from the spot you touched the ball down, you had to pass it and kick it good to score.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. That game, a Canadian historian, let me pull this out, a guy named Earl Zuckerman.
Wait, wasn't Crick?
It wasn't Crick. This is Crick's grandfather. It said, in those games, a player could only run if he were being pursued by an opponent. When the opposing player gave up pursuit, he called out to the runner, and he had to stop and kick the ball.
Oh my gosh, that was like freeze tag.
Or stoop tag or something.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, and
this is so Harvard.
Yeah.
If I stopped chasing
I'm relinquishing my pursuit of you. Right. So thusly you must stop.
Must stop and kick it.
Very good, sir.
And then in the second game, the rumor was, well, why don't we play with the Canadian ball,
mm-hmm.
which was slightly oblong, as opposed to the round ball that Harvard was using.
Okay.
Right. I don't think this game actually ever happened. There's a lot of talk that was an 11-on-11 game,
mm-hmm.
Because the McGill team came down sick with food poisoning after game one, and so I think if a game was played, it was a 13-on-13 game because McGill decided they only had 13 healthy guys, so Harvard mm-hmm. agreed, okay, we'll play 13-on-13.
Okay.
But I found this, and this is from Zuckerman. He says, there's no list of players in any paper, and human memory is so frail that the one survivor who was known to have played denied all knowledge of the game.
And the second game.
Yes. And when he was asked to name his teammates 30 years after the match, he couldn't name any. And so he claimed this guy was the only person who was known 30 years in this
right.
run to have played in the game. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. We never played such a game.
I think where it's coming from is that because the references to the second game all come from this one article from the New York Times that was covering it. And that article referenced the letters between the schools when they were organizing the game.
And
so I think that the person didn't cover the game. They kind of did a Mitch album where they just like assume that the game happened.
So that
wrote
was the
about
agreement,
it.
Right?
So the agreement, I think, was to play two games.
Okay.
One by the Harvard rules and one by the McGill rules. And then when they got there, I think McGill begged off the second game.
Because I think maybe they got sick, and maybe that story about food poisoning is right. So I don't actually think that game ever happened.
Well, if you ever say the word food poisoning and reference the old football players, they got drunk.
Okay.
Take your script out and substitute.
Right. That was my first impression when you said
that. I didn't think of that.
These are still college students. They're miles away from school. That's what happens.
They're drinking the American beer, and that's what kind of did it.
But, yeah, I know. You know, the Canadians had better beer.
Yeah, there was a lot of food poisoning in the early football for some reason. That's
all right. And so, in any event, but they did then later play that year
in 1874.
Yep, third game, and this one was in Montreal.
Yeah,
and in that game, they did play with an oblong ball. That game did happen because it was reported copiously in the Montreal Gazette.
Right, and it's the reason that the Canadians say, "Oh, we invented football as well."
Because the first and you know, that's not crazy, because
it's a lot more football than they played. Yeah,
it's a lot more plausible argument that was the first football game, Harvard and McGill, than Rutgers and Princeton.
If you say that the first Harvard McGill game was a game of rugby, and the Princeton was certainly a game of soccer.
In
Boston. And so if you call the first game between Princeton and Rutgers soccer, and if you call the first game between Harvard and McGill at Harvard, and the one that Harvard, I think Harvard did like a scrimmage against Yale too back then, right?
It could be right.
Yeah, but if you call both of those rugby, when you go to Montreal and they play with an oblong ball, 11-on-11, that is the Canadians' version of that's the first game of football ever played.
Yeah, the only thing I can say about that game in Canada, though, I don't think it was 11-on-11. I actually still think that it was still a 15-on-15
right.
game. Okay. But in other respects, it was more rugby-ish than soccer-ish. But still, touchdown didn't count.
Well, I was going to say, what details do you have from that game, briefly?
Like,
did it look and feel like football? Or
I
more
don't really think
scoring
so.
Field dimensions, anything
football,
like that?
Up until the 1890s, football and rugby were still pretty much attached to each other,
I do have this.
You say they were still the same species if you were if you're doing cladistics.
I've got this from the Gazette. It says the ball used by the McGills is of oval shape, made of leather, and twice the size of that of the Harvards. The principal point of difference in this game is that the ball must be kicked over a crossbar placed 10 feet from the ground between two upright 15 feet high, and that the party catching the ball on a bound can run with it and retain it until he kicks it or it is forced from him. But one thing that's clear is that you have to kick it to score.
Right.
I mean, running across the line doesn't give you anything.
And they also still have a scrum.
So
if you are downed, if they take you down, then you A, have to give up the ball, but you can have a scrum over it, just how rugby has now.
So let me ask you, did they call the game back then, did they call it rugby, or did they call it football?
Sometimes they called it rugby, sometimes they called it football with a hyphen, and sometimes they called it rugby football.
Right.
And so it was...
More confusion.
Yeah, it was called... All of those things. After that game, though, Harvard had a difficult time finding opponents because nobody wanted to play that.
They wanted to play rugby.
They wanted to play rugby at that point. They didn't want to play soccer, and everybody else says, the hell with you. But in 1875, they found Tufts, who had never played a game, the Jumbos, good nickname. Tufts College, yeah.
Is it in Ohio?
No, it's in Boston. It's in Medford, I think, just outside of Boston.
Okay.
And so they were willing to play. There's some rumor that that's an 11-on-11 game. That's a preposterous story. It wasn't. It was still
Boston rules.
It was still Boston rules. It was still a 15 game. But it may have been played, and it might have looked similar to the game up
in Montreal. Yeah.
But not too many people are playing that game.
No one in the United States, except for Harvard.
If the game of football, as Walter Camp imagined it, was around at that time, then people would have called that game the game that Harvard was playing rugby. And if the game that Harvard was playing kept on until today, we would say that, you know, all these colleges play rugby. So it was. You have to go back to the point where rugby was not necessarily established either, right? Mm-hmm. In 1871, is when they first have a rule book for rugby. So like these games are all still kind of in that speciation phase, right?
Yeah.
So you can do chicken and egg forever with these things because it's really kind of the same game that's splitting off from each other.
Yeah.
And the American game
is a good way to say it.
Is coming out of this the colleges as they play each other. As they argue over rules, and a lot of it's kind of over player safety, or like this doesn't make sense, or this team just figures out like, oh, if you have to kick it every single time, or if I give up pursuit, you have to stop. Then you can't get 2 yards.
But the ball still resembles a rugby ball at this point, does it not?
The Boston rules, under the Harvard rules, Harvard wanted to play. Once they played McGill, they wanted to abandon a small round ball and change it into a larger roundish ball.
Yeah.
But it's still not a football or anything like a football.
So let's back up. When you say small round ball, like a softball or like a basketball?
Smaller than a basketball.
Yeah, okay. It would be like, let's say you took a basketball and really beat it up. That might be kind of, or like, you know, let some air out of it and punched it really hard until it was like kind of flat. Mm-hmm. That's almost kind of what it would look like. It was not certainly like a spheroid up, an oblong spheroid as it is today.
Yeah, there are in the dailies that I read in the 1890s. There's ads for footballs. Mm-hmm. You can buy them at the time, and this is 20 years later. And you look at them, and they look pretty roundish, more than oblongish, because they have like a drawing of them in these advertisements. So I'm guessing the ball is round, not like a football, but roundish.
It's in the process of getting standardized, and like the look of the ball. A lot of times, the school would bring the ball. Right. So we ask, "What's the ball look like?" It looks like Harvard's ball, right?
Yeah.
I've seen some of these. It's a 12-inch, 14, or 16-inch. They actually play some sort of softball game with it, but that's, you know, about that, right?
Yeah, it would probably be bigger than that. I'm not sure. This isn't a Chicago softball.
No.
You know about that game they play with the 16-inch softball
in
Chicago? It would have been bigger than that.
Bigger than that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just to give some sort of...
Yeah. So. Okay.
All right, so these teams are playing through 1870s. We only have a few official games, but a lot of these schools are organizing their teams, and a lot of them are starting to play their own version of rules, and the rules are getting so mixed up that they start meeting with each other and saying, why don't we standardize some rules?
And these meetings are hilarious. I mean, the reports of them are just great because they get into... Kissing matches and screaming matches.
Right.
And
they're mostly students. They're mostly
There's no professors or faculty or anything involved.
There's a few former students, and those are the adults in the room.
Yeah. But a guy named Walter Camp at Yale really was tireless at trying to organize some sort of standardized rules.
And Camp, just to get in his mindset, he wanted a more gentlemanly game. He wanted one that made more sense, that wasn't like an old English sport where you're just constantly moving the ball. He wanted stoppages of play. He wanted a line of scrimmage where, like, you know, you have to start on your side, you have to start on your side. He wanted to abolish the scrum, which took forever. He was tireless in advocating for that. And I think he actually advocated for some rules that didn't end up in football that later kind of became football rules.
Like, so he wanted something different.
He wanted something more like the game that we have today.
Today,
right?
He used a brilliant word that you have to use that for football. Situational. He wanted it instead of like, you know, the game constantly moving,
right? A beginning and an end to each play, right?
And I think it's probably it might have been influenced by baseball, which is an incredibly situational game too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Where like there's, you know, instead of the game constantly
flowing
and people going in all sorts of directions, like, let's stop. All right, here's our situation. It's third down and 5, and
the
ball is here, and we got this far to score, and we got this much time left, and like the drama out of a situational game is what he was trying to put into the game instead of this just
roughhousing.
That's
pretty brilliant back then when you think.
Yeah, it was,
like that.
And really, I think Camp does get credit for. this attempt at standardization, yeah. even though it was incredibly difficult, and he couldn't really get anybody to go along with him.
Because every school came with their sense of rules, and right. they all just wanted, let's adopt the Cornell rules, let's right. adopt the Harvard rules.
But how many schools are we talking about now?
7 or 8 at
yeah.
most.
Okay.
Yeah. At most.
And they're all on the Eastern...
Like half of yeah. them are the Ivy League today. And okay. the other
I mean,
half
you're
are
talking
like
about Harvard, Yale, Princeton, maybe Rutgers, maybe Stevens Tech. I mean, but they really didn't have much of a dog in the fight.
Yeah.
And
Cornell.
And maybe Cornell, but I don't
Brown
know.
University Brown. Had a team. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. But that's about it. And okay. And so the I think an important thing to consider, although I don't think this is written anywhere, is that just the fact Harvard had to play Tufts mm-hmm. was so degrading.
I demeaning? Mean, yeah.
Yeah, it was demeaning for them that they were going to play their rules, goddammit, and we're not going to play any of these dumb...
I mean, it's like if Michigan State decides that we want to play with 12 men from now on, Michigan right. State is not going to play football without 12 men. Screw right. you, old people who play with 11.
Wow.
And the only people who will play them... Is
Lansing Community
right.
College. And that's exactly what it was like. So Harvard was completely humblified by this.
Wow.
They were completely humblified that the only school they could get to play them was Tufts, who
right.
had never played a game and may have never played a game again, for all
right.
I know.
And, sacrificial.
And so
it's too bad with a great name.
Come on, we're going to play this game, right? Like it or not.
Yeah, and so I think some of that led Harvard to at least begin to think about, okay, I guess we have to negotiate this stuff. We can't just impose it.
Gotcha. But their choices are limited, right? Because not people are accepting of these new rules.
And because yeah. the negotiations are going so badly, they need a compromise guy. Yeah. And I think that's where Camp kind of scoots
right.
in and says, so, here's rules. And he like had them printed out on a sheet right. and goes, here they are printed out. Take these.
But the first attempt didn't seem to work at all. It was
yeah.
like in 1877, I think, mm-hmm. or 76 or 7. It was a flat earth theory. They couldn't get anybody on board, and it was the same old, same old.
So quick bio on Camp. Where is he from?
He's that's interesting. He's a Yale guy
he's
for
a
sure.
Yale
yeah.
guy. Okay.
Yeah, and but I his bio.
But he breaks away. He wants to have a unique.
He
game.
Wants to have the unique game. But then the big thing happens. And I looked at a lot of games in this period, the games I could find writings on. And to me, the one thing is clear is you. Even while the rules are somewhat different, the one thing that's sort of the same always is touchdowns don't count.
Okay.
Touchdowns
yeah.
just give you
yeah.
the opportunity. For the try.
But then in the fall of 1878, Camp makes another attempt.
Yeah.
And
so up after that, whole thing, there was like a split between schools that wanted something more organized
right.
and schools that kind of favored this thing called old division football, which was mostly similar to the rush.
Right.
It was put a ball in between people on campus and then everyone right. fights yeah. over it, right? And there was this, like, one of the schools, I think it was Dartmouth, who like had the old football division. And what happened was everyone started hating Dartmouth. So in the interim between this original fight and when they get back together in 1878, Dartmouth managed to piss everybody off with their idea of like rush football or old division football. So when they come back together, that's the scenario, and I'll set you up there.
Yeah, and so somehow in 1878, Camp creates this set of rules. And if you read those rules, some of them are curious, like you're not allowed to wear gutta percha. Which I'm not sure what that even is. I think it's like spikes, you know.
Okay.
I mean, coming out of your knees or something.
Okay.
But, you know, but it has a bunch of rules. But
these are things that people used to use in the rush. You would, like,
right.
you'd come out dressed like an orc from World of Warcraft.
Right, exactly.
Or like one of the Oakland Raiders fans. Like one of the Oakland Raiders
right,
fans.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so there are things like that. You can't wear spikes on your uniform. But, I mean, it also has... It also says for the first time that four touchdowns equals 1 point.
One
goal or a try.
Well, you have to cross the line four times
yeah.
to get the opportunity for a try.
No. Each time you cross the goal, you get a try.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you cross the goal, it's worth 1/4 of a successful try.
My gosh.
That's what the rules say.
Wow.
And the idea was, I mean, keep in mind that there wasn't a whole lot of passing back then meant throwing the ball back,
backwards. You couldn't throw it forward.
Passing,
which
would
is
be like
a rugby
a
derivative, correct?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So getting into the end zone was not considered like the coolest thing in the world. Getting in the end zone and then scoring the try, kicking that field goal, was kind of, because where the game came out of again, came out of this idea where you have to get the ball down and kick it over a goal. And like that, it was so hard to get that idea that kicking the ball off the ground into a goal was the way to score. And like throughout all these early years, you see this just like them holding on. Okay, fine. Touchdowns can be like one quarter. And if you get four touchdowns, then you can get a
I've even got a hard time accepting that now. A quarter of a point?
Right. And so, in any event, those were the rules. So when I first, you know, started, and there were some other things about, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe you remember them, Seth, but there was a sequence of rules that made it look sort of like, in some ways, like football today.
When they get our book, they can read them all over again.
Yeah, and but so I, when I first read this, I said, okay, this looks like the first time I would say we have something that's called football. Who played the first game under these rules?
Okay.
And so I expected that it would be somebody played a game in late September of 1879
or 1878.
Yeah, but yeah. The rules weren't until late 1878, and there were no games after it.
Oh, interesting.
And so it wasn't until 1879 that any games could be played really under these rules.
Okay.
Well, I looked.
So we'll stop here. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll get into that game.
Yeah.
This is Matt Demrest, the owner of HomeSure Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGLO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use HomeSure Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our company. Complicated loan. Brian used them, you should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homesurelending.com, that's HOMESURE lending.com/mgoblog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me, kind of an annual tradition, Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
I got a little bit of that down on music, Lord, it's been overdue. City for some funky little sweet home blues. Meet me in Chicago. Baby, I'll show you around. Meet me in Chicago. Let me take you downtown.
Okay, so we have the rules in place.
In camp. I
in one camp thing rules, that, at the end of 1878.
I have to remember, there was one other thing I forgot about them, is the camp won the debate about how many players. So even though there were no basically 11-on-11 games, camp manages to be successful and convinces Harvard, who's been humblified by having to play Tufts, that it should be 11-on-11. So the
state is still mad.
Yeah, right. And so they.
But that's a big distinction.
That's
point.
A big distinction, and it ends up being in the 1878 rules that that camp is successful in getting other schools to agree.
I
want to
back
with.
Up a few months too. Before, during the fall, like early fall, back then you put the games together that like season. So like if you're going to play each other in September, you talk to each other in August and put the game together and then you go play.
Right.
And that lasted throughout the 1890s, I think.
Later sometimes. I mean, because you'd see in the daily, Michigan will play Hiram College today. And then Hiram College wouldn't show up and it would be somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, because you never, it was week by week, these schedules.
And road trips were dangerous too
road
sometimes.
Trips were dangerous,
so.
Yeah.
So how did you find these rules?
I actually found, I had a hard time finding them. I found them in the back of an old Spalding magazine from, and I'm not sure the year of it. It's in our writing, the book
set. Is it in a library or is
It was on, the great part about the University of Michigan is everything is online.
Okay.
And I kept looking and hunting and hunting
Online.
And I found it online in the back of an old Spalding sporting magazine.
That's an incredible find.
And so in any event, I said, this is it. This is the rules. Mm-hmm. So this is when it sort of turned into football.
Time zero. That's time zero.
For me, it was time zero when I looked. And so I then said, okay, what was the first game in 1879?
So back up. In 1878, in the fall of 1878, Racine College challenges Michigan because they have a football team and they're playing against each other. And they'd heard that Michigan had organized a football team and said, "Oh, if you guys are playing each other by organizing a football team, that meant they were playing each other,
right?
The sophomores were playing the freshmen, etc." So Racine heard that Michigan had a team. Racine's all the way out in Wisconsin, so they can't get anywhere near the East Coast to play a game. And they're just casting about trying to find someone. They hear great big University of Michigan has a team. Hey, why don't we play a game in Chicago? Michigan writes back, we don't even have an 11. We can't even get the sophomores to talk to the freshmen. You want us to have a game? And so they hash it out. They argue over whether, what are the rules going to be. They agree on a Boston rules, on like a rugby basically kind of rules. And then Michigan says, look, you have to give us more time. We can't play until like next year because we guys haven't trained together. We don't have an 11 that plays together. We don't even picked our 11 yet. You're going to have to give us till next year. So they move the game to May.
May of 79.
May of 79.
May of 79.
And in the interim, camp passes these rules. Right. So while they're arguing over the rules, this new rule sheet comes out. And so they say, why don't we agree to the camp rules? Okay. So Michigan
Racine. Is that documented?
There's a.
Where they have a correspondence where they say, let's use the new camp rules?
I believe the correspondence still exists because a lot of it was printed. So here's the challenge. Dear sir, this is from. This is September 1878 from C.L. Cleveland, the secretary of the Racine Athletic Association.
Okay.
Dear sir, we have organized a foot-ball, 11 of members of our college, one of the objects of which is to create an interest in for athletic sports in our Western colleges. We, knowing that you, having a football team, are exceedingly desirous of playing you this fall. The best offer we can make is this. Chicago seems to be the most convenient place. We will see that the White Stockings grounds are procured, tend to all the advertising, and give you 2/3 of the gate money.
Wow.
We play according to modified rugby rules, which we will be able to send you in printed form in about a week.
So, is the board in control of athletics existence?
No.
So why do they say before your association? So, is there a governing body?
Association are some students.
So it's the team.
Yeah, they're the closest thing that I could connect them to, like on a modern campus, would be like the intra-fraternity council.
Okay.
That's basically what they are.
There wasn't an athletic association at Michigan until the early 1890s, where anyone could join.
Right.
It cost you $3. So for $3, you could be a member.
And the $3 went to getting us an indoor facility. That was towards the Waterman, yeah.
And one of the early members of that was, of course, Charles Baird, who was a student and eventually took over.
Right.
But that's another story. And became the first athletic director, but that wasn't until 1897, maybe?
We're 20 years later, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Americans are incredibly democratic, so anytime we have eight guys together to play a football game, we're going to elect a secretary, we're going to have a treasurer, we're going to have,
So it's loosely, agreed upon.
That's what they were.
The Chronicle got wind of this. The Daily wasn't quite on the scene yet, and the Chronicle got wind of this, and they started hand-wringing right away.
Yeah.
I mean, they were like, the editor said that a defeat at the hands of Racine would be a pretty hard grind, and And they, you know, they were continually lamenting the fact that no one at Ann Arbor was practicing for any such game.
Well, and they kept on tying that back to the fact they didn't have a field house. So, like, we don't we can't practice because we don't have a gymnasium.
And Racine did.
Yeah, and Racine did.
So they could practice indoors all
winter.
So
they wrote this in April. Now that the snow is gone, it is high time that our teams were hard at work every day. But they are not. Indeed, they seem to be distinguished only by their laziness and lack of enthusiasm.
So that went on all winter.
Wow, trading barbs.
All right,
No, that's not trading barbs. This is Michigan's own. This is like the version of the Michigan Daily.
This is
my god.
Selling the football team. You haven't practiced. The Racine game's coming up in a month. What are you doing?
And we're going to be humbled by by Racine little.
And they've got a gymnasium.
Yeah. So in any event, so this game and the Racine. Said, look, we'll get the White Stockings Park.
Yeah, which is the Cubs, by the way.
Which is the Cubs, okay. Yeah. And we'll give you, because you're coming further than us, we'll give you 2/3 of the revenue.
It's a big deal.
It was a big deal because these sort of fights were just crazy in the 1890s and in the 1880s.
I mean, these games are so rare. I mean, you had about 10 of them in the span, 10 games total, and probably 7 teams playing each other in the entirety of the decade prior. Yeah. So now, like, from the Princeton Rutgers to now, you haven't had many of these games, and these guys are going to get together in Chicago. This stadium, where this is where the, quote, White Stockings, but now that franchise is the Cubs. But they played, I think that the lake was a lot closer back then, but, like, Lake Park, that area, like, when you're driving into Chicago and you have that beautiful park, like, downtown.
Sure, it makes sense.
Yeah.
You're a lot closer back
then. It was the Union Baseball Grounds, Michigan Avenue and Randolph Street.
I love the uniform reference. I wonder if Dooley has that mentioned on his uniform timeline.
Yeah, I that was from the Chronicle. I took a note of that, too. They presented quite a neat appearance. The uniform is of white canvas, close-fitting with blue stockings and a belt. So there's the original Michigan uniform.
Blue stockings. I still have a hard time with that.
They had blue stockings, they had blue belts, and the rest of it was white. So that was a road uniform. So.
But I think that was the deal back then because, you know, the Red Sox, the White Sox, now Racine is wearing purple stockings.
Yeah, right? So
that was the differentiating
You would uniform. Have, like, an athletic smock that you would put on. So, you know, you would normally wear your regular shirt and your pants.
Like a tunic?
And it was more kind of like a
vest?
An athletic uniform that they put that these guys would have. And, like, I'm sure you've seen lots of pictures of old baseball players. It looked exactly the same, right?
Okay.
And that was like an athletic uniform that you kind of put on when you're going out to do your sports, right? Like your gym.
I saw that Crick had the picture of the first Michigan Notre Dame game, and it almost looks like it's a like a bib overall, almost like a I don't want to call it a jumpsuit, but it's like a one-piecer. It's a bottom and a top buttoned up.
Basically, what these were is like if you had gym class and you had to like put on like you know your gym clothes. Mm-hmm. That's what this basically was. And then teams would differentiate themselves by the color of their socks.
Gotcha.
And they would do this in like schools too. Like if you wanted to know who the other team was, you'd put on that color sock.
That color sock.
And that's why you have teams like wear the white stockings, the glass stockings, or the
glass socks, or the
Boston
Red Sox, or
so when
or Tigers because they had stripes on them.
Yeah. So when did they finally agree to play the game?
I think it was probably
late May.
The game was in late May.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, they agreed to... Michigan got the challenge in September 78.
Okay.
They agreed, and then promptly were like, uh-oh, we got to put a team together.
Right. So they're not ready to play in 78.
And so they put it off, and then they delay it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, camps rules come out.
Right. And I've got something from May 17th in the Chronicle of that year. It was front page story with all kinds of hand-wringing, saying the boys were finding any excuse not to prepare and should, to the contrary, be practicing, quote, every possible moment to the exclusion of study, amusement, girls, everything. And then they were just gloomy as possible, saying, wondering whether or not in 1 month we can train a team here that will at least make Racine's old 11 work in order to win. Now, Racine's old 11 was also probably college kids.
Yeah.
And they never played a game either. It wasn't like they were out east playing old Yale or old Harvard.
Right.
No, they were building it up as like the, you know, oh, these guys are murderous, but they're not as civilized as us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, that's funny that you say that because there was some sense to that all through the period.
Yeah.
That the further west you were, the more the less civilized you were. And you'd see it in the Eastern papers, in particular when Michigan went out to play the Eastern teams in the 1880s, they would refer to the Michigan team as like backwoodsmen and things
not
like
as refined. Oh, they were so patronizing when they played us.
Patronizing,
like we come in like, oh, Michigan acquitted themselves well. Even though they were defeated, they were much more civilized than we thought they would be.
Right.
They followed all the rules and they brushed their teeth.
Yeah. Highbrowed and everything. Huh?
Yeah. So
yeah.
In any event.
So this game comes, right? So finally the game comes and Michigan
May
does repair.
In May of 79.
Yeah. By the way, Jim Harbaugh, just to let you know, the media was after the first team too. It's not just like a recent thing.
Right.
So when we're critical of you, look what they used to write about your team, all right? Anyway, the day comes. On Wednesday, they get together, and they're all in their uniforms in front of all the students in Michigan, and they're cheered, and they get on the train, and they go.
Okay.
I think they spent a day on the train. The Day Express, it was called. It gets you to Chicago in 24
day.
Hours. Yeah.
Wow.
But that was what the train to Chicago was called. And it went through... I think it's South Bend of this exact train.
I think that's right because that's eventually how the Notre Dame games came.
Right.
Came to be.
So this train, and that train doesn't exist anymore now. If you take a train from, if you take the Amtrak, it doesn't go through there anymore.
Yeah, you do the North by Northwest, Niles, the Wajiak.
Right. But it used to have a South Bend, and I'm sure it annoyed everybody because it added so much time to go down to this South Bend, and that's where South Bend, Indiana comes from.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, they go through the South Bend. They get into Chicago on Friday. I think they slept on the train on Thursday
Probably.
Night. Yeah, Friday morning they get in. They go and they hang out in Chicago on Friday. They stay in town and they're up at like crack of dawn and out in the field practicing. And like they got a new sheet of rules that morning and they're all like hashing out the last little bits. And they didn't start the game until like 4:15 p.m. There's 500 people there to watch.
That's right, 500.
It's like super hot. It's even hot for May. And they have two, quote, innings. Which
innings.
Are halves.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're
although 40. Earlier on, an inning was until a point was scored.
Okay.
in other words, they, you know, although not always, some, you know, but in some games they would, in the early games, they'd say an inning was, okay, a point is scored, that inning is over, we're going to play, you know, two more.
Right,
whatever.
Right.
So.
Yeah, so these innings were 45 minutes. They were timed innings at 45 minutes.
And this,
so they're halves.
And this was very unusual because I think this might also be the first time game.
Yeah?
I think every other game was not a time
it is
game.
It is a Walter Camp rule.
Yeah.
That they're
it's interesting that it's 45 minutes because that's a soccer time, right? Mm-hmm. The halves are 45 minutes each.
That's right.
Well, okay. I think it goes back to Walter Camp was all into the situational game, right?
Okay.
Instead of just having like you know things willy nilly, I want how much time is left on the clock. We got to get going.
Right. Okay.
And again, scoring a touchdown meant that you get a try.
Right.
So to score a touchdown, you had to put the ball down in the end zone. You couldn't just be standing in the end zone.
Couldn't just cross it.
You couldn't just wasn't just crossing the plane. You had to be down, touch the ball down in the end zone. In fact, being down meant the ball went down. Any part of your body back then could touch. So the guys would like go down and crawl on their backs to try to get a couple more yards until the ball was pushed down onto the ground.
Okay.
But if you touched the ball down in the end zone, it was a touchdown, and then you got a try. And the try was you had to like flip the ball from where you touched it down to a guy who held it, and then somebody else would kick it, or you'd flip it on the ground and somebody else would kick it.
Is that being contested, or is that just a you're basically kicking?
You know,
against the...
I've often wondered that, and I'm not 100% sure.
Mm-hmm. So they were camp rules, so there's a line of scrimmage, but there isn't. You didn't have to have a certain number of guys on the line back then.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, when you look at the positions, we'll get through their positions when we go through the guys. But like, rusher was kind of what they would call a blocker, but those guys were lined up in the back, and the primary blockers were the halfbacks who were you know half of the way into the backfield.
Okay,
but anyway. So Michigan does score in the first half, or does get a touchdown in the first half, but they don't convert the try. So they're giving off to this guy, Irvin K. Pond.
Irvin Pond.
Right.
And the Rooters are cheering, Pond forever, Pond forever.
Pond forever. Do we have a picture of him?
I think there is.
Because I'm looking at the team. I'm trying to find out which one is him. I don't know if he's got the handlebar mustache or what.
That's a good question. I'm not.
I think he was one of the older guys on the team.
There is a picture. I know. He also, incidentally, was an architect.
Well,
and he designed, I think, the Michigan Student Union.
He did, and Purdue's Union.
And Purdue's Union.
And Purdue's
Union. And a whole bunch of buildings in Chicago, too. Yeah. He was a major major architect.
There's a picture of him later on, but it's not a handlebar mustache.
We're getting off the game, but I was going to talk about all the players as we go, but
yeah.
He gets into a rivalry with Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I did not
they were
know
like,
that.
They were both kind of that arts and crafts era of architecture.
And they were both in Chicago.
Frank Lloyd Wright?
Yeah.
The Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yes. Yeah. So the two of them, I think they were both kind of considered part of the same movement, and they were like rivals. And they're like
Prairie School.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I think someone made a list of like the great architects, and they included Pond. Pond and his brother were in there, so it was Pond and Pond. Okay. And they included Pond, but they didn't include Wright. And Wright like wrote like a really nasty thing about Pond, being like, how come he's on this list and I'm not? Yeah. That kind of thing. Anyway, Pond scores, but David Tatar, who's their captain, and he is the, I think, one of the best players on the team.
He was probably the best player, as far as I can, from...
Yeah, and he was kind of the guy who had organized a lot of the stuff, too, and started the Athletic Association a few years earlier. He's also the kicker and missed the extra point, so it doesn't count. So they get no points in the first half.
Right? Okay.
So they got the touchdown, but Michigan, according to this, is just dominating the game. They're keeping the ball in the Racine end all the time.
Okay.
And... You know, scoring is difficult. They finally get in the second half. John Chase scores. He apparently had scored a couple times, and so the Rooters were yelling, "Chase is there! Chase is there!" because they thought he had gotten in already a few times. And finally, they count him in, and Tatar makes the goal. So Michigan wins 1-0.
Right.
Which I think if you... want to convert it, it's like a 13-0 game.
So they give credit for Pond for scoring the touchdown, but it's not a converted score.
Yeah, unless you convert the score, you don't get anything from it. You look at the names, really the words that we use for all these things now make a lot more sense in the context of the game when it was back then. So, yeah, a conversion was you got a chance to score because you touched the ball down in the end zone.
Yeah.
Now you get a chance to convert.
Sorry.
You convert, you get 1 point. So that's why it's a 1-0 score.
Although Rule 7 says games are to be decided by a majority of touchdowns. And a goal kick from the field counts as 4 touchdowns.
Crazy.
So I don't know how you want to call it. I
think they weren't using the camp rule for that.
Right.
Because this is like this is the rule that they same used with Harvard.
But later on, I mean, and when you look at the Chronicle, when they wrote about the game later, they say the game closed with a score of 1 touchdown and 1 goal for the university team. So they did seem to count the touchdown. And later writings, including John Behe, you know, when he wrote Fielding Yost's Legacy, writes it as a 1 point, 1.25-0 game. In fact, he said in Behe's book, Fielding Yost's Legacy, he said that technically Michigan won 1.25-0.
Right.
So
what he's saying is that Pond's touchdown counts as a quarter.
Right.
And Chase's touchdown, because it was converted, counts as 1.
A four. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you want to convert it to a modern score, it's a 13-0
game.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, but in any event. But
that's good to know.
Yeah. But you could see why the extra point, which seems like such a ridiculous exercise in football, like we just had this...
why it's still there.
Right, we had this big battle to get into the end zone. We got to the end zone, and now we're going to just sit and have a kick? Like, why are we doing this?
Right.
And that's where it came from. Like, you had to convert it, and it came out of these old rugby rules where the original goal of the game was to kick the ball over the crossbar.
Right. And in fact, over the next 20, 25 years, they would argue about scoring.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a while, touchdowns were 4 points. I mean,
which, interesting, if you go back and convert the point a minute teams into modern scoring rules.
It's unbelievable.
It's way more than a point a minute.
An interesting thing about that is when I first heard about point a minute, I assumed it was apocryphal. And then I went back and looked at the scores and
No, it's not.
They were getting 5 points per touchdown back then.
Right, and it was more than a point a minute, and especially since a lot of the games were like
you know, teams would walk off. I think we were ahead of Ohio State 128-0 right. after 30 minutes, and they walked off the field, so I don't even
know. Yeah, very few teams made it to the third quarter against Michigan, in the, or made it to the fourth quarter in most.
In the
point. So I think that's Pond.
That must be Pond.
Because I'm looking at that.
That's it. That's the picture. The next one is the one I recognize when he was older.
So that's a few years later. Yeah. That looks like a younger version.
Yeah, that's probably
Okay, wow.
All right,
so that's May 30th of 1879.
Right. Yep. And that's the first game that was played post camp rules.
Right.
And
they're using camp rules. They are using most of the camp rules. Right. The scoring rules, not
why
much,
isn't this talked about more? This is the first time I've heard about this.
Well, it's in Hail the Victors.
Yeah. Seth published my article about this a few years back.
I think it was in the 16 edition or 2015.
Yeah, I remember that. You disputed the Princeton Rutgers game.
Well, you know, and there's no one out there. There's no historian or anybody else out there who claims Rutgers Princeton is the first football game. Mm-hmm. That no one seriously is. The only people who do that are like color guys on football games.
And the Big Ten.
They don't know.
And the Big Ten.
Yeah, and the Big Ten.
Right. It's just like with the Abner Doubleday story for baseball, where like years later, when it's a huge, huge sport and everyone in America recognizes the sport, they say, where did it come from?
Right.
And then they go back and they see, you know, in 1869, Princeton and Rutgers played a football game, and that's as far as they would go.
That's as far as they go.
Yeah. And then, you know, if you go back and actually dig under the story, Admiral Doubleday did not invent baseball. Admiral Doubleday never saw a baseball game in his life. But they needed a story, and they needed an American origin for it, because having this, like, very messy origin where, like, we're not sure of the rules, and, like, some people are playing them these way, and so, and like, there's actually another game that's kind of already been breaking off from this game, because there's rugby style where you pick up the ball, and there's football, European football, where you kick the ball. Like, it's just too much for people. They needed a simple, simple answer, and so they came up with this Rutgers-Princeton game, and let's call that the first game. And even today, we're wearing patches. And who was it? Someone suggested that, like, Michigan changed the number on the patch.
Oh, wow.
So is there
a... Go ahead and do it. But.
So, I mean, if you're talking about the first football game, I mean, I'm not sure it's important. Yeah. But to the extent... To the extent you're talking about the first football game, it really can't be Princeton and Rutgers. It could be Harvard and McGill.
Yeah.
The third Harvard and McGill game in 1874. That one is at least, there's an argument, but I still think the closest you can get to the first real football game is 1879 Michigan and Racine.
Right. And then there's a whole bunch of them afterwards. So 1879.
Sure. Yeah. After that,
kind of explodes from there.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Correct.
But do we have the correspondence in the Bentley of where they're having the exchange of letters between Michigan and Racine? Who are they corresponding with? Who's the Michigan point person?
Was that Dittar on that one? I don't know.
Dittar would have been he was the captain of the team, so he's the one they would have been talking
organizing.
To. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. But, I mean, and that whole the whole, I mean, these are our students who are putting these things together. So and then I think that a lot of these come back out of their recollections later.
Okay.
So maybe we don't have the letter so much as like Dittar talking about the letter.
What happened and how they organized this game.
Right. Because, I mean, these guys are around for years later. One of them's out in California, and like when the 1901 Rose Bowl team comes in, like, you know, he's there to help them fet, and then like he gives them dinner and stuff. And
yeah, and locally, this game was a big deal. I think.
Yeah,
they were doing it by Western Union.
They were. They were sending telegrams.
Play by play.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they weren't doing play by play. They got like every 20 minutes they got an update, and they would have a guy on Velocipede, which is a
I didn't know until I read that story.
Yeah. You know, a bicycle is a type of Velocipede. If a bicycle is the one that has two wheels,
but the front wheel is huge and the back wheel is small.
Well, Velocipede means all of them.
Oh. Okay.
I'm sorry. I had to read up on bicycle history last night, but yeah. Velocipede means any kind of cycle like that, and then bicycle is specifically one where the two wheels are the same size. This guy had a velocipede. We don't know what kind, unfortunately,
but
basically a kid on a bicycle had to go from the telegram office down to where everyone was gathered and shout out what had happened, and then because no one could hear him when he shouted because everyone was rooting so loud, he would have to deliver it to a guy who'd write it up and put it on a board.
Right.
So they had to wait for it on the board, and like they hadn't heard about the touchdown because it happened late in the game, so it's still nothing to everybody until at 6:28 p.m. the board writes, game finished, won by Michigan, one goal kicked by Dittar, and He writes, the gathering of students manifested their feelings in the usual student manner.
Oh, she's getting drunk? I don't know. That's funny. I didn't know that.
And speaking of getting drunk, the Michigan team got feted at the Palmer House.
Yeah.
Which, if you know your Big Ten history, in the same room about 10 years later, they created the Big Ten in the same room. So there they are. They Michigan
Big
wins.
Big Nine, actually.
Yeah.
Big Nine Western Conference, correct?
Right. Although yeah. It wasn't even nine.
No, it was.
It was like six or five.
And it was their second attempt at it. They had a Big Ten and a conference already, and it folded. Wow. And folded. Put
they,
together.
They never could get it together. It wasn't until.
Right.
Even after 1900,
so there's no schedule laid out for this year in 1879. They're not playing five.
No.
They just agreed to race.
They're playing in May. Yeah. I mean, this is just like there's students who are like, hey, let's get together when the snow melts and let's.
Sure. Yeah. So that's May,
right? And so they have this banquet at the Palmer House, and they come home and they're heroes, and you know. Michigan is the winningest team in the history of football because they're 1-0 and no one else has a single victory.
No one's played yet.
And here we go. So I think we're going to take a break. We'll come back, and I want to talk about the team, and I also want to talk about the Toronto game they played that year.
Yeah, they played Toronto.
When I have learned what progress has been made in modern gunnery, when I knew more of tactics than a novice in a nannery, in short, when I've a smattering of elemental strategy. Strategy. Oh, my word, that's a hard one, isn't it? Wait a minute. Got it. You'll say a better Major General has never sat a sea.
Say a better Major General has never sat a sea. Say a better Major General has never sat a sea. Say a better Major General has never sat a sea.
Military knowledge, though I'm plucky and adventury, has only been brought down to the beginning of the century. But still in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern Major General.
Encore! Can you do it one more time?
Deadly!
And can you do it really fast?
What's this? In fact, when I know what is a member, mammal, on a reveling, when I can tell a side of mouth, a rival, from a javelin, with such a face, sources, and surprises, I'm aware yet, and when I know precisely what a member commissariat. Oh, when I have learned more progress of being made in modern gunnery, when I know more of Texas than an novice in an honorary, and sure, when I have a smattering of elemental strategy, or say a better Major General has never rode a horse! For my military knowledge, the line plucky and adventure has only been brought down to the beginning of the century, but still a matter of vegetable, animal, and mineral. I'm the very model of the modern Major General!
So we kind of skipped over the guys themselves, and there's not a whole lot of them, so it shouldn't be that much to take. And I can't really speak to their football abilities too much in a modern context, but, I mean, they were all pretty interesting dudes. I'm just going to start with the halfbacks. Edmund Barmore from Indiana is the first guy to play quarterback in football, apparently.
In football or Michigan football?
In football.
Wow.
Well, there hadn't been that many games.
Right, right.
So he's the first one to kind of line
up. Michigan has the first linebacker in Schultz, right?
Right, yeah, but that's much later. And that's, but I mean, I think what he did is he backed up and took a pass to start the play as opposed to picking the ball up off the getting the ball off the ground.
Okay.
Which receiving the snap as opposed to, getting the ball and then starting literally a quarterback. Now we can claim we have the first quarterback, too. You know,
right.
Michigan claims everything.
Might as well claim that, too.
Yeah. So he's a son of a steamboat builder. He was the director of the Athletic Association after some of the other guys graduated. So he was younger on this team.
Okay.
And you could tell because if you look at the picture of this team, his mustache really needs a lot of work. But if you look at him later when he's an adult, that mustache just comes in, man. It is like one of the greatest mustaches of all time.
Yeah, dude, it's right up there with Laney McDonald, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't know if it was red or not, but that's impressive.
I mean, it's curly, it is bushy, it's just got everything in the world going for it. This is a top 10 mustache of all time.
Yep.
And I love that the team photo for the 1879 team shows it in its infancy.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He's certainly a teenager then, for sure.
So another halfback is Charles Campbell. His dad was a regent.
From Detroit.
Yeah. So he was the guy who studied under Angel. So I don't know if there was an argument between student and professor over this the silly game he was playing.
Well, I kind of, you know, the thing is, I'm not sure that Angel perceived football as worse than the rush.
<That's right>.
So
Right.
I know Angel didn't like football, thought it was violent and shouldn't exist, but, mm-hmm. you know, he probably thought the same thing about the Rush.
Yeah, so Campbell goes on to be a big-time lawyer and civic leader in Detroit. I want to point out there's a photo of him at Mariners Inn where I do my volunteering.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So, like, he was a trustee there, so, like, wow. They have a wall of all their old trustees. Another halfback, he was like one of the best athletes on campus, is Collins Johnson. He didn't make the Chicago trip. Okay. So the reason why we got a couple of those rushes from – reason why Irvin Capon got a couple rushes, because I guess he wasn't maybe the best athlete there after all.
Okay.
Because he was supposedly behind Collins Johnson from Grand Rapids who couldn't make this trip. He ends up being a surgeon at Harper's Hospital in Detroit, and then he goes on to be the district surgeon in Grand Rapids. Some of the breakthroughs he made in typhoid fever are the reason why nobody has typhoid fever anymore.
Wow, kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
This guy, I was talking to Craig about him during prep, John Chase. He only plays a little bit on this team. He becomes a doctor and then later a general. General John Chase,
wow.
Who founds the Colorado National Guard, becomes the commander of the Colorado National Guard, and also founds the Denver Medical College out there. Those are the nice things that you can say about General Chase. Chase is mostly known for the Ludlow Massacre. If you go and look that up on Wikipedia, you'll see he really hated strikers. And fired on them and killed. And
wow.
I don't know if he gave the direct orders, but he certainly took the heat for it, and I don't think he minded that it happened.
Wow.
So he was a very hardline anti-striker responsible for killing a bunch of workers in the process.
Yeah, probably a Michigan graduate that we want to sort of shove under the rug,
I now have a least favorite Michigan least football favorite player. John Chase. Team one. Yeah. Yeah. We already talked about Irvin Capon. He was also an amateur acrobat, we didn't mention. He's a very fascinating guy. So he was the architect. He also built the home insurance building and Hull House for Chicago people who recognize those, the Oregon Public Library, the Union at Purdue, and the Michigan Union. Richard Dupuy from North Dakota. I tried to track down where he was because he was on like all these teams. He was on the 81 team that traveled. He was on the 82 team. He stuck around for a while. His brother William was also on the team. I think he just became a physician. And then the company that he worked for, I tracked it, and it became Johnson & Johnson.
Huh.
Yeah. Wow. So he wasn't like a founder of Johnson & Johnson, but the company. And last rusher. These are linemen, by the way, when you say rusher. But rushers also could... hold them. We're also ball carriers. It's the very strange version of the game.
Right.
This is David Tatar. He's from Iowa. He's the first captain. He became a doctor back in Iowa afterwards.
Okay.
But he was kind of the guy who was doing a lot of the organizing, and Tatar was kind of running around to the other sports on campus, specifically, I think, the tennis team and the baseball team he recruited from to put this team together in the first place.
Okay.
Randolph R.T. Edwards. He's the father of Tom Edwards, the All-American. Oh no, the guy who didn't become an All-American because he got sick and missed a couple games in 25. Mm-hmm. So the star left tackle for Benny Friedman's team. This is his dad. Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing about R.T. Edwards, his family was from Warwickshire, England, and they owned a rugby rule book.
Oh, wow.
From Warwickshire. So like when he showed up, I don't think he's the one who brought football to Michigan, but I think when they found him, he's like, oh yeah, I got a rule book.
Oh my god, you're on the team.
Right. He became a lawyer and teacher. I couldn't find anything about Frank Reed, who's lifted his left side. Right side, I couldn't find anything about Jack Green except where he was from and went back to Austin, Texas.
Okay.
Is it possible that Reed and Green were not students? I mean, it certainly wasn't uncommon.
Well, because you know what? They weren't ready to play in 78, right? Maybe they didn't have enough players to field a team.
I would imagine at this point they were because, like you said, like later on when college football becomes a big deal, then everyone's bringing in ringers. This is before that time.
Before the ringers.
This is like when everyone who's anyone who's playing like really believes in this amateurism thing, and they're all in there like, what you call it, the Christian
muscular Christianity.
Muscular, Exactly. Like, that's what these guys think they're doing out here. Okay. Right? So I would imagine they're not. I think it's just hard to track everybody who played on this team.
Especially many years later when you've got a name as uncommon as Frank Reed and Jack, Jack Green.
This is part of the problem.
Right.
William Hannon or Bill W.W. Hannon from Dowagiac, he was known as the best athlete at school. He was one of those guys that, hey, come play football. We'll teach you how to play because you're the best. Their problem with him is that he kept on missing practices to go study law. So when the Chronicle was complaining about players not really
focusing,
they were talking about William Hannon. He became a real estate developer. He was a top real estate guy in Detroit in the 1900s.
Wow.
And then goalkeeper, which should be basically a safety, I think is the position we'd call it today. It's Charles S. Mitchell from Minnesota. He became a big-time newspaper publisher. When you talk about like newspaper guys who got us into wars in the early 1900s, you know, like the whole Yellow Journalism era and got us into the war.
Spanish-American War.
And World War One. He was like, I think his paper was the first paper to call for America getting into World War One.
Wow.
So he was one of those guys. He was also an attorney when he graduated, and he was a captain when he was a senior. Frank Gates Allen, couldn't find anything except for he owned a Moline Plow Company in Moline, Illinois.
Yep. Yeah.
And his home is now the home of the Moline Board of Education.
Wow.
And then there were a couple other guys, Albert Pettit, who went to real estate in Baton Rouge. Did you – you said you
– Yeah, and someplace when I was scrounging around, I discovered that this is the grandfather, I think, of Bob Pettit, the
basketball player?
Basketball player who is in the NBA Hall of Fame. Great player in the 1950s for him.
Yeah, so he and William B. Calvert joined the team, I think, in the fall. So they're listed as subs for this team, but I don't think either one of them made the Chicago trip.
Okay.
So that was the team. They have another game in the fall that they organized with Toronto, which I knew the Canadian of our triumphant year would appreciate.
Yes, once again, a Canadian reference. Ding,
right.
Yeah. Ding.
Craig, how did the game with Chicago come about?
Boy, I don't know on this one.
With Toronto, you mean?
Do you know how the Toronto game?
I was hoping you did because they would have like you know some people talking about how they organize these things. It just says that they put it together.
I know they played in Detroit. That's about all that I know.
Yes, I think that's true.
Yeah, they played in Detroit. So they played on the grounds. They just built, where Harper Hospital was.
Okay.
So, like, right next to there on, like, Brady Street and Beaubien, they built a new grounds for the baseball team because they were hoping their, like, minor league baseball team would become a major league team.
Okay.
And the team was the Detroit Wolverines back then.
Right.
Become the Detroit Tigers. So they built this field, but the field was brand new. So they built the field for like the following spring, mm-hmm. and they didn't get to play on it in 1879. So this is November 1st, 1879. So the first game, organized game of anything played
on that field,
on this field, which was built for the Detroit Tigers, is this game.
Well, you know, Seth, I'm going to have to find out now. I mean, I have to figure out how did this game, because it's in May when they play Racine, and then
5 months later, right?
Well, typically they would play these football games in the fall.
Right, and they were usually the earliest was October 1st, dead earliest.
Yeah.
And often they would play them into December. And
you play your scrimmage games in October, and then like your November was when you would play
your
games.
Serious games.
Right.
And so I don't know how this one on November 1st, 1879 actually came about. I don't know. I'll try and find out.
Yeah,
if not, I guess we can ask Greg Kinney. Maybe he knows.
Yeah, so here we are on a podcast about this team and half the games we don't actually know very much about. But I couldn't find anything. I looked on we don't have daily archives yet because the daily doesn't exist yet.
Right.
The Chronicle has just the result of the game published.
Yeah, as a footnote, I think I might have mentioned this one once before. Before the Daily, Michigan played a, quote, football game in 1885 against the Princess team of Detroit. And the game was played at the Ann Arbor Roller Rink on roller skates. And it was reported, and Michigan doesn't count it in their records, but but the Chronicle does list it as a football game, saying Michigan won 2-0 in two innings. I have no idea. I can't tell you how much time I spent trying to find out what the hell this game was or who was in it or anything else, but all I've got is a few brief lines in the Chronicle. So finding... Yeah. It isn't necessarily the fact that even a lot of research will tell you, give you much information about this.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to look up what I could. I tried to figure out more about the Toronto team, and you know, it was there's not much there too. The one interesting thing I found is that they list the referees. Each team brought their own umpire.
Yeah, that's ordinary for a.
Yeah, and then there was one referee, and they were excited to get Captain Rogers of Yale. I don't know who Captain Rogers is.
Uh-huh.
I looked through the list of Yale captains.
Uh-huh, and you can't find him.
And you can't find him. Captain might be his first name.
That's possible, or it could just be a lie, because
Well, you know, this guy's referenced by Yale sometimes, because like 20 sure. years later, he's like sending letters back. He's off on his travels during the off season, and there's a reference to him telling the Yale guys, practice your kicking and punting.
Okay.
So like he's a venerated guy at Yale, right. But no one refers to him as anything but Captain Rogers. I have no idea what he's captain of.
Okay. So he's the referee, but then each team has their own umpire.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
So that was kind of what teams did back then. You have your own guy, kind
of. Often in many of the games, each team brought their own guy, and there would be two. That would be it.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy was in charge for the first half, and then the other guy was in charge for the second half. So there was sort of a primary referee and a subservient referee, depending on which half it was.
Right, which comes into play in the Oberlin game.
In the Oberlin game,
yeah.
Which both schools claim they won to this day.
Can I read this here? It says, this is from the Free Press. Given the novelty of the game in Detroit, the Free Press devoted much of its coverage to educating readers on the rules and methods of play. The paper described it as football of the scientific kind in vogue in all universities and throughout England and her provinces and known the world over as rugby. Interesting. The paper noted that the field was 300 feet wide and 400 feet long. At both sides stood two 12-foot-high posts about 20 feet apart. White lines were drawn in plaster to mark the boundaries of the field. Remember, we talked about this before. Mm-hmm. A string was drawn from one post to the other 8 feet, to the other 8 feet from the ground. And the point of the game was to get the ball over the string or the goal. The game was declared a draw after the two teams played two hard-fought 45-minute innings without either team scoring. The Free Press called it, lastly, one of the most exciting sporting events ever seen at Recreation Park.
Of course, I think it was the first.
Yes,
but, you know, and it
is. It's awesome.
Yeah, so, you know, but it's probably worth some time trying to track down
you just saw the problem. Like, the only articles about that game are describe, you know, they don't describe what happened in the game because no one knew what the game was. So
yeah.
They just described the rules of the game.
The game was scheduled to start at 2 p.m., but the players did not arrive on time.
There is a thing from the Chronicle about the students, because like a whole bunch of students went down there to Detroit the night before and partied, and then 250 students got on a train, which is about as many people as you could fit on a train.
Yeah.
250 students got on a train that morning. There's only one train going to Detroit that morning, and they all got in and they walked, I think, several miles from the train stop
to the park.
Right, and so there's like 250. Imagine like 500 people is the most that you can get into one of these games, and 250 students are boarding a train in the morning at Ann Arbor, arriving. I don't know what happened on the train on the way, but it must have been quite a show
I have a question for you about this game, Seth. And is this University of Toronto, or was this just some team from Toronto?
The city of Toronto?
Yeah. I mean, was it the Toronto Football Club?
I think it was the University of Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and a number of Canadian excursionists were also in the city. I love that. Canadian excursionists. Yeah, but to your point, there's not much else written about this game.
Yeah. It does underscore how Canada was really, you know, going right along with United States at the time. It wasn't just an American game. Canada was... Canada had gotten the sport at the same time the Americans did, and...
Well, you know, and more than that, I think you could say that the Harvard-Montreal games were pretty much the way that football evolved in the United States. I mean, those weren't football games, but they sure changed the nature of football more than anything else, and McGill was...
Yeah,
you know, most prominent.
Well, the thing about the University of Toronto, they were the Blues, by the way.
Yeah, that's the university. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
They claim that they were the first football game ever played between within their own school.
Okay.
In 1861.
So they played a football game, an intramural game at Toronto.
Yeah.
Well, it's worth looking at. I mean, I didn't know that.
It is, but it's again. There is no such thing as the first football game. Right. These games come out of people, moving a ball around and agitating a bag of wind for the sake of doing so.
I think you're right. To say the first football, I think we can say that Princeton and Rutgers was not the first football game.
That's right.
But beyond that, I'm not, where you go, I'm not sure.
I'm Dr. Sapp. Thanks for joining me and Seth Fisher on the First Teams podcast of 2020. Next time you see a Canadian, give them a high five and thank them for the game of football, eh?
Well, you guys are taking credit for that, too?
Andrew Pierce sucks!
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
Great!
You'll be a mission here, boy!